From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now, or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello and welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noah.
They call me Ben, and you are you that makes this stuff they don't want you to know.
The gang's all here.
The gang is all here. And we're talking about something that a lot of people have some very passionate opinions on.
Yes, and this is that old disclaimer that we make in front of every podcast that has to do with anything religious or belief system that is held tightly, and that is that we are not telling you what to believe.
Your beliefs are your own.
Yes.
There will be no poo-pooing of faith.
Right. Yes. Every single person has a right to their own personal spiritual beliefs. To posit otherwise would be, at the very least, not well thought out.
Correct.
And it's kind of an anathema to what we do overall. We're not here to tell you what's what. We're here to look at some sides of issues and present it all as fairly and balancedly. Is that a word? As
possible. Yeah, balancedly. Yeah, yep.
Mm-hmm. Just American English. Everything's a word.
I couldn't agree more. So what we're going to do is examine the history of one particular religion, look at some, you know, sides to it that maybe aren't explored very often in your daily ongoings.
Yeah, it's very important. We're looking at this from an historical academic perspective. We want to give a shout out to a friend of the show, longtime listener, Henry H., who gave us this idea. You might remember him from our previous episode on the FBI and counterculture. And our whole disclaimer thing, basically, I feel like what we're always implying is Scientologists in the audience.
Oh, man, we left out a disclaimer on that last episode, though. It should have said, don't do drugs.
I know.
Oh,
speaking of,
right.
Speaking of.
Yes.
Everyone listening, we discourage you from doing drugs outrightly.
We cannot legally tell you that drugs are cool.
Most importantly, though, we were joking when we said we were on drugs doing that podcast.
Oh, yeah, that is very true.
That was a joke based on that. I know you guys probably know this, but we just have to say it again. We were sleep deprived, me less so than these fellas, but we were playing off of that sleep deprived vibe and riding that like a crazy snake to Valhalla. And I hope everyone was aware of that. If not, and you thought we were dosing up in the studio, I'm here to tell you otherwise.
And we appreciate all the emails we got. We had several people write in and say, hey, just be sleep deprived all the time. But Noel did a great job editing, because the raw form had some...
That cutting room floor was brutal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Slippery.
So here we are. Religion. The big R. The earliest evidence of religious ideas dates back hundreds of thousands of years, all the way back to what is commonly called the middle and lower Paleolithic periods. And just for some perspective here, the average creature qualifying as human during this time would probably disturb you if you just saw them walking on the street today.
You at least wouldn't recognize them as human.
Well, even if they were wearing, you know, the clothes that you yourself were wearing,
yeah,
you would notice some obvious differences. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to get too caught up in this, but we did an episode on what are called the, like, lost races of humanity.
Such as Denisovans, mm-hmm. Looking at differences between Homo erectus and Homo sapiens.
Mm-hmm. Neanderthal, mm-hmm. and Homo floresiensis.
Yep. Are those the little...
Uh-huh. Yeah,
the little skeletons that have been found?
Mm-hmm. On just a very small patch of the world. And the current debate is whether it was a true speciation of some sort, or whether it was just a community condition, for lack of a better word. So do check that out if you haven't checked it out before. And there's another thing that's really interesting. You can hear our colleague and occasional guest on the show, Joe McCormick, who works over at Stuff to Blow Your Mind, when he and his co-host Robert Lamb did an episode on what is called the bicameral mind. This is crazy. There's this theory that for part of human civilization, people were not self-aware the way you are now. Mm-hmm. Like if you're listening to this, you're thinking in your head maybe, I am listening to this. Right.
Yes.
Just thought that sentence, right?
And then the words that you hear are translated into your own thoughts.
Yeah. Like an internal monologue.
I usually just see them visually as like letters in a cartoon spelled out in the sky, you know? Is that weird? Is that?
No, I think it makes sense. You got the word balloons.
I think I might be working with a tricameral mind.
Oh, jeez.
So what happens is the idea is that in the distant past of civilization, instead of hearing a voice in your head and thinking, that's my internal dialogue. That's my internal dialogue. These early people would hear a voice and they would think,
holy crap. Somebody's talking to me. Who is that in my head? What are you? Why are you? Are you there?
Are you there, God? It's me, Kragnar. You know? And one piece of evidence for folks who believe this is the dramatically different writing style of the Iliad. In the Iliad, classical scholars amongst us will remember, it was written somewhere between 800 and 725 BC or BCE, whatever your favorite flavor is. Mm-hmm. Characters just sort of do things, you know, and their motivations for a large part of this story are kind of not present. Just something happens. Yeah. Things just happen. And since we know Greek culture very quickly became a literature of consciousness, the Iliad is sometimes seen as a great turning point, a tipping point. Shout out to Malcolm Gladwell, and a window back into what they call the unsubjective times. And every kingdom was a theocracy and every man was the slave of voices heard whenever novel situations occur.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. And religion might also predate humanity, depending on how you define religion.
Right. So higher order mammals like cetaceans, a new word, fancy word for dolphins and whales that I just learned, elephants, canines, they all recognize the difference between a living thing and a corpse. Hopefully you can as well. Millennia before Homo sapiens existed, its predecessors and parallels practiced some form of ancestral recognition, which is an understanding that the body was nothing but a vessel for the mind or an idea. And then archaeologists refer to apparent intentional burials of early Homo sapiens from as early as 300,000 years ago as evidence of religious beliefs, which makes sense to me.
Right. Yeah. They realize that something was there.
There is a ritual going.
Yeah. And then it's not, and a ritual occurs. Other evidence of religious ideas include symbolic artifacts from the Middle Stone Age sites in Africa. But of course, it's kind of tricky to interpret this, you know? Even in the best case scenario, there's room for interpretation, which is going to be important as we explore this. Archaeological evidence from more recent periods is less controversial. Number of artifacts from the Upper Paleolithic are generally interpreted by scientists as representing religious ideas, meaning, in general, a bunch of really smart people who have spent their lives figuring out what this stone shard means all got on the same page and said, you know, cool, they knew he was dead and they did a thing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I suppose you could also argue that with enough experience, you know, you might realize that a dead thing starts to be gross and we should probably just get it out of sight and out of mind, or it makes you sad. So you don't want to look at it anymore. So let's bury it in a hole in the ground. Just devil's advocating here.
Yeah, that's a very good idea because, many animals, if a member of their peer group or their mate or their offspring dies, they just leave. They're just like, all right. Next.
Yeah, but I like it here. I don't want to have to look at dead, rotting grandma for the rest of, you know, until for the foreseeable future. Let's get her out of, let's bury her in this pit.
Ah. Yeah, there are people
that's
who
morbid, guys.
No, there are people who keep the remains of their loved ones. And Faulkner has a great story about it, but of course, spoilers, just in case
for a 100-year-old story.
Yeah, man, always.
Well, okay, so
spoiler trolls.
So we talk about these, let's talk about like examples of things that are clearly agreed to be religious. The Venus figurines are, you know, a rather voluptuous, often headless figure, right?
Certainly looks headless. All of the examples that I've seen.
Mm-hmm. And there are elaborate burial rituals around the world. There are cave paintings. But where did this all come from? That's today's question. What prompted early humanity or its close predecessors and parallels, as Noel said, to ascribe occurrences in the physical world to the whims and the systems of something unseeable?
Is it drugs?
Maybe. Well, yeah, what connected either the bicameral mind, what connected the parts of the brain that were previously not connected? Or, you know, was it just an evolutionary thing? Or was it a chemical?
Yeah, or was it a social thing? It's essentially, we're not sure. Like, we as a species are kind of still tossing this one around, spitballing.
But there's theories, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's theories. Let's call one, we had to do it. H-A-D-D. Oh, it's not funny for you guys yet because you're listening and you don't, it's funnier if you read it.
This is a theory that was put forth by Kelly James Clark. He's a senior research fellow at Kauffman Interfaith Institute at Grand Valley State University in Michigan. Ooh, that is a mouthful.
That's a lot.
So he believes that humans on the Serengeti who, quote, survived to procreate were those who had developed what evolutionary scientists call a hypersensitive agency detecting device, or HADD, H-A-D-D.
The pun, the joke.
It comes, see,
comes around.
Right?
It comes
see,
around.
Fourth dimensional pun, guys.
So in basic terms, in plain terms, this meant that people who were more likely to survive and reproduce, and pass on their experiences as well as their genes were people who perceived that many other things in the world, external things, have agency. And what we mean by that is the ability to act of their own accord.
I have agency. Other things have agency. Like what else? What would have agency? Animals walking around might be one of the first things you notice.
Secret agents.
Other humans. Secret agents.
To be fair, he didn't say human secret agents.
I know, you didn't.
You never know.
Could have been.
You never
like
know.
Perry the Platypus on Phineas and Ferb. He's a secret agent with agency who is also a platypus.
Gotta tell you, I don't know what that is. What is Phineas and Ferb?
It's a great show. It's like a kid's show, but adults like it too.
Ah, all right.
Kind of like an Adventure Time thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's a Disney show, but it's actually very clever. It's very well written.
Looking into it.
Do it.
While you're looking into it, you'll notice that this had, H-A-D-D, this understanding of how the world worked facilitated this rapid decision-making process that people had to go through when they, for instance, heard a rustling in the grass. So, yeah, perfect. So not so much stopping to reflect on the transience of life as going, holy smokes, lions do what they want. I better run.
I love that picture of some of the first humans understanding that lion can come over here and attack me at any time. Not just, oh, there's a lion dead.
Not just the grass moves, but the grass moves because something.
Yeah,
because. So that's the kicker, right? In addition to helping humans make rational decisions, survival-based decisions, HADD may have planted the seeds for what we know as religious thought.
Is it sort of like object permanence, where it's sort of like, you know, that thing will always behave in that way, or that thing is only behaving this way at this moment that I'm observing it. This is so sort of like that if a tree falls in the forest and you're not around, does it make a sound? Or it's like if my mom is there behind that bush, is she really not there at all?
Yeah. Yeah.
Those are important distinctions. That's all I'm saying. Like, well, those are things that we come to psychologically as we grow older. But it's important what we're talking about, you know, in terms of evolution to make those distinctions that allow us to actually learn from our mistakes.
And it's absolutely crucial. And it's one of those early developmental milestones, right? Like when your children are growing up, there are really sensitive times in the early years when all of a sudden they have that eureka moment you see it happen.
Yeah, I've seen it firsthand recently with my kids, especially with mirrors. Little things like that. We don't have to go into it. Anyway, it's cool. But
mirrors are weird still.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just animals and other things moving around that they ascribed agency to.
Right. Yeah.
They also ascribed it to things.
Sure. These raindrops now are falling on purpose.
On drop tops.
But yeah, things that absolutely don't have agency, like drop tops. I don't know the first human.
Yeah, raindrop. You got to make the top drop. Don't drop on its own.
Drop top.
You got to apply
something
agency. Something
drops
to
the top though.
Right.
Yes. Right.
Yes.
So when that rain falls, like something dropped that rain. What was it?
Yeah, like creation demands a creator.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're sitting in this room right now recording this, and wait, someone is going to cut to an ad break.
It's me.
And we're back, but who was it?
It was me.
It was definitely me.
Yeah, he says it was. I gotta believe him.
But you don't see it happen. That's the magic of podcasting. That part happens away from your prying eyes. In the same way that some sort of prime mover, creator, deity drops the drops on the tops what drop.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God. Mm-hmm. But where does the drop ultimately drop? Here's another theory about religion. What if instead of a single individual adaptation or Shyamalan plot twist in the story of humanity, what if it's not just a story about things that apply to individuals reproducing? What if religion is more of a group adaptation?
Ooh, I could go along with that.
This is an idea by Robin Dunbar, an evolutionary psychologist and anthropologist at the University of Oxford in the UK. His work focuses mostly on the behavior of primates, including, you know, things like baboons.
Why does he sound familiar to me?
I think you know.
No, I don't.
He is the famous proponent of something called Dunbar's number.
Ah, you made a video on this.
Yes, and we talked about this on the show, too. And it's the idea that the human brain is physiologically limited. Think about, for anyone who works with computers extensively, think about the physiological hardware limits of a computer.
Sure.
There's some software it can't run. There are some things that it doesn't have enough memory to store, right? We run into this often, as you can imagine.
Daily.
What was his number? Is it 100-something?
It was 214-653-9999.
No. You're... Okay, yes, you're right.
I think it's, 1-8-8-8-8. You know what? Just keep hitting 8.
It was a, 150 maybe, 150 humans.
150 to 200.
Yeah, humans that you can ever really maintain a relationship with. Anyway.
Or see as a peer.
Yes.
And then after, see as, you know, the way that you see your friends, you understand that they are the main characters of their own story. And no matter how close you are a cameo. You are a secondary character in everybody else's story. And after that number, your brain is just incapable of understanding that those other people past that, like number 347 that you meet, is just the thing that takes the garbage out, or the thing that walks by you on the way to the bus every morning.
The thing that runs the Justice Department.
Right. The thing that you vote for.
Ooh.
You know? It's a scary idea.
Yeah, it is.
But Dunbar also applies this thinking to religion, in that he says that religion may have actually evolved as what he calls a group-level adaptation, which we mentioned before, religion being a, quote, kind of glue that holds society together. We've also heard it as referred to as the opiate of the masses, a similar yet antithetical notion to that in an interesting way.
Yeah, perfect, because it is like that's religion, an ideology, a value system is a way for – number 347 to have something in common with you, you know?
Yeah.
Now it's not just the thing in the Justice Department or the thing that cooks the food. It's also the thing
that believes what I believe.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And there's one more theory. It is one of the most controversial theories.
Do we need another disclaimer?
Whew.
If you're feeling uncomfortable at this point,
stick your fingers in your ears.
No. Yes, do that. And then also rewind back to that part where we had a disclaimer and then come back here. Just to reassure yourself.
Here's the question. What if the original inspiration for some of the world's most influential religions was ultimately not evolution, but hallucinogens?
Whoa.
That's right. Magic mushrooms. Psilocybin.
Simple Simon?
Have we already said psilocybin?
Let's say it again.
I think that's where Simple Simon comes from, because it kind of sounds like psilocybin.
Yeah, it's a homonym.
How about those Mario make big bites?
God's flesh.
Did you make that last one up?
I don't know.
Is that in the vernacular?
It's a mushroom, okay?
It is now.
I love mushrooms. And when I say that, I mean I love delicious mushrooms.
Like portobellos.
Shiitakes. Shiitakes, trumpeters, the weird ones, the weird bulbous looking ones. But as we know, when you grow them a certain way, certain species, they can get a little funny. Make you feel a little funny. Think a little funny. See things a little differently.
Here's where it gets crazy. In his book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, an author named John Marco Allegro argues that, quote, our present concern is to show that Judaism and Christianity are cultic expressions of an endless pursuit by man to discover instant power and knowledge. Granted, the first proposition that the vital forces of nature are controlled by an extraterrestrial intelligence, these religions are logical developments from older, cruder fertility cults. With the advance of technical proficiencies, the aim of religious ritual became less to influence the weather and the crops than to attain wisdom and the knowledge of the future. Essentially, his argument is that modern religions, especially the Abrahamic ones, Judaism, Christianity, Islam to a degree, sprang from these ancient fertility cults.
I got to pause really fast here and just point out that I've never thought in my head about a religion as focusing on an extraterrestrial intelligence, as an intelligence that is not on Earth or of Earth, even.
Yeah.
When you say it that way.
Isn't that what, like, all religion is?
Yeah, it is. It is, but I've never used it. I've never used the phrase extraterrestrial intelligence in that manner of thinking about what God could be or is.
Extraterrestrial has become very specific in our time,
yeah,
or at least in our version of this language.
You know? It's become this kind of like, there's like hokum surrounding it to the point where you can't use it in a way that people don't sort of like turn their noses up at, in a way. You know what I mean? I don't know. Like, not all people, obviously, the people listening to the show, and we are, you know, into those explorations, but the term extraterrestrial, which when it really just means not of this earth, has become sort of a buzz phrase that has negative connotations in terms of like its use and veracity. But I think it's totally applicable to what God is, to what religion is, to what these deities actually are. They're totally extraterrestrials.
In many ways, people, regardless of their particular religion, would say this is something beyond us, to some degree incomprehensible or darn difficult to comprehend. Allegro goes on and he argues that these ancient cults had knowledge of psychoactive drugs in plant form, but they prevented this knowledge from becoming too widespread. They were the shaman, you know, and they were the priests.
And the quote is, quote, these were the drug herbs, the science of whose cultivation and use had been accumulated over centuries of observation and dangerous experiment. Those who had this secret wisdom of the plants were the chosen of their God. To them alone had he vouchsafed the privilege of access to the heavenly throne. And if he was jealous of his power, no less were those who served him in the cultic mysteries. Theirs was no gospel to be shouted from the rooftops. Paradise was for none but the favored few. The incantations and rites by which they conjured forth their drug plants, and the details of the bodily and mental preparations undergone before they could ingest their god, were the secrets of the cult to which none but the initiate bound by fearful oaths had access.
That reminds me of ayahuasca rituals. It's a laborious thing,
right,
to create this substance that will take you on this spiritual trip.
And the ritual of ingestion is as important as the substance itself.
Yes.
In times of war, though, a widespread social disruption, something happened. These orally transmitted mysteries became difficult to transmit. Right? People were dying. People were being imprisoned, enslaved, slaughtered en masse. So the priests had to write this knowledge down. And Allegro's idea is that they wrote it down in an esoteric or coded form that only another priest, only another initiate would recognize.
And be able to translate, essentially, mm-hmm. if you're going to teach someone else about this.
And Allegro argues that the specific instance where this occurred, the turning point, was the Jewish revolt of 66, AD 66. And we have a quote on that one, too.
Instigated probably by members of the cult, swayed by their drug-induced madness to believe God and called them to master the world in his name. They provoked the mighty power of Rome to swift and terrible action. Jerusalem was ravaged, her temple destroyed, Judaism was disrupted, and her people driven to seek refuge with communities already established around the Mediterranean coastlands. The mystery cults found themselves without a central fount of authority, with many of their priests killed in the abortive rebellion or driven into the desert. The secrets, if they were not to be lost forever, had to be committed to writing, and if found, the documents must give nothing away or betray those who had dared defy the Roman authorities.
So this need for coded communication about the use of sacred plants and the performance of sacred rituals, then, again, we cannot emphasize this enough, according to this author, according to Allegro, it led to the creation of a rabbi named Jesus. To tell the story of a rabbi called Jesus and invest him with the power and names of this magic drug, to have him live before the terrible events that had disrupted their lives, to preach a love between men extending even to the hated Romans, thus, reading such a tale, should it fall into Roman hands, even their mortal enemies might be deceived and not probe farther into the activities of the cells of the mystery cults within their territories.
Oh, it sounds so cool.
It's a grand conspiracy.
And this guy Allegro acknowledges that his subterfuge failed, as evidenced by the majority of Christians who believe Jesus Christ was an historical figure, not a metaphor for a psychoactive drug in some sort of mystery religion.
But what drug was it, you might wonder? We have one last quote.
Above all, they forgot or purged from the cult and their memories the one supreme secret on which their whole religious and ecstatic experience depended. The names and identity of the source of the drug, the key to heaven, the sacred mushroom, the fungus recognized today as the Amanita muscaria, or the fly agaric.
So, let's take a moment, guys. What do you think? You want to do some pros and cons?
Sounds like all pros to me.
Speaking of all pros, his argument hinges on pros. Or more specifically, etymology.
O-S-E?
Yeah. We're getting weird with the puns today. It relates the development of language to the development of myths and religions and cultic practices. So, for example, he relates mushrooms to fertility or experience of the divine. So he's connecting it to the phrase son of God. He's arguing that since he's tracing this back to fertility cults, he's arguing that the mushroom, by being an encounter with the divine, was seen as, you know, the offspring of God. And in some ways, it might be seen as like a reproductive fluid. In other ways, it might be seen as the flesh of this extraterrestrial divine creature. He believes ancient evidence about the other phrases used to refer to this stuff will bear out the argument. And he does acknowledge that it's largely concerned with words and titles. And he believes that only when we discover the nomenclature of this sacred fungus within and without the cult can we begin to understand its function and the theology behind it. So, you know, this leads into naturally the concept of eat of my flesh. He also talks about the visual similarities between iconic depictions of the crucifixion and the shape of a mushroom.
I feel like that's kind of a stretch, but I mean, I get it.
And lest we not forget that a mushroom does bear some resemblance to a phallus.
Oh. Male reproductive organ.
Phallus in Wonderland.
Gotta say, specifically circumcised in most mushroom cases.
Lewis Carroll is such a creep. I just want to put that out there. He's a creep. Did you know that part of his diary pages were torn out and destroyed? on his death?
Because they were that.
It was too hot for TV.
We'll never know.
There's also the idea of manna from heaven being the bread of life that comes from God himself, itself.
Yeah. That's something that mystifies a lot of people, especially growing up with a belief system. A lot of people, you know, think that manna is something on a tree, like an apple or, you know, a other fruit.
An orange?
Sure, yes.
Pomegranate.
Good save.
Wasn't it like a the way you regained health in the Final Fantasy games? Wasn't that manna?
I think so. It was definitely magic in Skyrim.
In most RPGs and games I play, manna is, yeah, your magic power.
Which comes from this. I mean, it's this idea that it's sort of a replenishing spiritual force that it can be squandered and regained, or it sort of feeds your spiritual life force in some way.
In Magic the Gathering, you have to tap your mana and make use of all the land that you control to cast spells.
Yeah, oh, yeah, you lost me. Oh, at boy. Magic. Right. More of a Pokemon guy.
MTG for life.
No, I'm kidding. I actually want to get into that. I've recently with the kid, she's finally got the attention span for games like that. And I'm the one who just wants to force her into it because I want to do it. I need someone to play with. Mm-hmm. So we've been playing Pokemon, but I'm going to try to graduate her.
Yes.
Magic the Gathering.
Oh my gosh. Tyler's. Oh, okay. You guys don't know who Tyler is. He's another producer here. His kid is like getting hard on the paint and with the Pokemon cards. And both of us are just banking that he's going to be ready to play Magic with us soon.
Isn't it really expensive?
Yeah.
Is it though? I mean, we have like three decks and, you know, I bought a couple of booster packs, but our decks are pretty well matched. I think what happens is you get tired of seeing the same cards over and over again, or you need to like trick your deck out so that you, you know, can defeat someone that has a super tricked out deck. But we digress.
And we progress as well. So the weird thing is, all right, we are fully conscious of the fact that this sounds like maybe confirmation bias. Maybe this guy just really wants to see it. But there are numerous paintings of religious moments in the Old Testament or the New Testament that clearly depict mushrooms. There's a 13th century chapel in France in there. There's a clear depiction of Adam and Eve, and they're next to a tree. It's very Garden of Eden, but the tree is made out of Amanita muscaria mushrooms.
Whoa.
And the serpent's coiling around the tree. It seems weird, right? That this would be the most, arguably, one of the most famous stories in the Bible, right?
Yeah, when Adam and Eve betrayed God, ate the fruit that was like the only thing you're not supposed to do up here.
So good, though, that fruit.
Well, apparently it was, and
that fruit.
There are a lot of beliefs that the fruit itself was knowledge of, like, what I am. You know, I am Eve.
Have you ever tasted pure knowledge?
No.
It's that fruit.
Well, in this case, what if it was the key that unlocked all of the mysteries?
Now that's good. I like that, especially compared to those quotes we were reading earlier. I mean, ingesting something, you know, like whether it's a metaphor or a stand-in for like enlightenment, but the idea that maybe it's not, maybe it's an actual substance.
Well, yeah, again, I go back to the Invisibles because Ben, thank you again for introducing me to that. But there's a substance in there, right, that allows access to a higher level of some sort, and it's some kind of hallucinogen.
It's like a slime. Scene where the guy likes, the homeless guy who kind of takes him on his kid, he like smokes something and then all of a sudden they're like through the looking glass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This idea is, you know, this idea exists on several different levels, metaphorical, literal. As you can see, it's open to interpretation, which brings us to some of the cons. Not Furry Con, not Dragon Con, not Comic Con.
So many cons.
So many cons. In this case, one big con is that all major scholars rejected Allegro's idea. And this guy's a legit scholar. His mentor was like, man, what are you doing, buddy? And the publisher who published it was like, we shouldn't have gotten involved. So the full text is available online, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. You can read it. You can read it online. It has its own internal argument, its own internal logic, rather, but it makes certain jumps, assumptions that leave room for criticism and invalidation. Just like the guy who wrote Chariots of the Gods, Eric von Daniken, it's easy for people to see what they want to see when they look at ancient writing and ruins. That's why, you know, in the beginning of the show, we talked about how even the most well-read, erudite people will disagree on the purpose or the intention behind an ancient thing that they found, the flotsam and jetsam of the world.
Because many times there's not another human or a piece of writing that will come out and give you a definitive answer. So ultimately, like a lot of things, you're left with your own interpretation or the interpretation of somebody who's studied it for a long time.
But, and this is a big but, it is certainly true that many religions have had relationships with psychoactive substances.
Oh, yes.
And we will wade into those psychedelic waters when we get back from this.
I feel like out of so many shows that we've done, this would be the one where we would just inexplicably pause for a psychedelic guitar riff. There we go. You're tuned in to Stuff They Don't Want You to Know.
Just keep looping that role in the edit.
Okay. So we've got some examples of different hallucinogens playing a role in different religions. Not just in the Abrahamic stuff that Allegro is talking about, but around the world.
In Book 9 of the classic Hindu text, the Rig Veda, this pressed juice called soma is mentioned as something that was drunk by priests, and some sort of visionary state is reported when you ingest this stuff. Like this realm where happiness and joy and all kinds of things just kind of combine, all the good, positive things mm-hmm. combine. And it's also where longing wishes are fulfilled.
And some people believe that soma could have been a psychedelic mushroom, maybe even Amanita. R. Gordon Wasson is a scholar who held this opinion. And in Food of the Gods, Terence McKenna says that a more likely candidate for soma, due to its better efficacy at inducing psychedelic states, is a different mushroom, the psilocybe cubensis.
This is a mushroom that can grow in cow dung in certain climates, which may explain why the cow has gained such a sacred status in the Hindu tradition. But other academics claim that soma was cannabis.
You know, and I've actually had someone make soma for me before, but it was not a hallucinogen. It was just this relaxing root.
There's also a pharmaceutical drug called soma that's like a muscle relaxer or like an antipsychotic, I want to say.
Oh, wow.
I think Aldous Huxley references soma in Brave New World.
And just to confirm what I said before, soma is, in fact, a drug on the market called carisoprodol, and its brand name are soma or vanadium, and it's a muscle relaxer that can block pain to the nerves. So you might take it if you have a skeletal muscle issue, back injury, or the like. I just think it's interesting this term has persevered over the years.
And in addition, there were other examples. The blue lotus flower was worshipped by the ancient Egyptian civilization, and it's now believed that this flower had some psychoactive properties itself.
Maybe a little naturally occurring DMT. We saw that in our exploration of DMT, right? There are tons of plants that just contain it.
Ah, yes. To everyone who's writing to us about DMT, we do have an existing, at least a video or two on it.
Again, dimethyltryptamine, don't do drugs.
Even though DMT naturally occurs in trace amounts in your own brain.
But don't worry about that. Just keep on keeping on.
And there are mushroom cults in Mesoamerica dating back to at least 1000 BC. These are indicated by mushroom stone effigies found in the Guatemalan highlands. In addition, frescoes from central Mexico also show signs of mushroom worship.
Then we get to these things called mystery religions.
Matt, that's right. The Eleusinian Mysteries were initiation ceremonies held every year for the cult of Demeter and Persephone in ancient Greece.
And there was this drink called Kaikion.
Spicy.
And it was consumed, which the Iliad says was made up of barley, water, herbs, and goat cheese. That sounds disgusting.
Mm-hmm. In the Odyssey, however, the character Circe adds a magic potion to it. And some people have speculated that the barley used in this drink was parasitized by ergot. That's a fungus that is believed to be responsible for intense experiences people reported during these mystery initiations and rituals. And ergot contains ergotamine, which is a precursor to LSD. You've also maybe heard about this as a proposed cause for St. Elmo's fire and mm-hmm. for the Salem witch trials.
Yeah, and all kinds of other vampire panics throughout United States history.
And just to put this out there, I've said it before and I'll say it again. Go see The Witch. One of my favorite movies of last year.
It's so beautiful.
In my opinion, this plays a part in that. It's up for debate, but cool movie.
Don't you mean The Witch? The Witch? Its titling is really cool. It's like two Vs.
Wouldst thou like to live deliciously?
Yep.
Black Phillip!
Oh, we haven't spoiled it, but we hope we've whetted your appetite for it. Write to us and let us know what you think about this movie, because we will literally sit around off air and talk about it.
I actually saw it with co-worker and fellow podcaster Lauren Vogelbaum of Foodstuff fame. But when it was over, we were both just kind of sat there looking at each other like, what? We saw something we weren't supposed to see.
I watched it alone in my house in the dark with headphones on. And I was unnerved in the most spectacular way.
I like to play it while I exercise.
Just watch The Witch while you work out.
Yeah. That and The Shining.
Hmm.
It just motivates
me. I get it. I get it.
Well, that's, we don't want to get too deep into the off-air stuff. But yes, The Witch is completely worth your time. So here we are with a cursory examination of this theory. Now, this, make no bones about it, this is very controversial. Some, indeed, found Allegro's exploration offensive. But it is, at this point, still an exploration only. It's completely possible that psychoactive substances have played crucial roles in numerous religions. We know they have. We know they have. Ayahuasca, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
However, if this specific mushroom did play a role in the formation of fertility cults that later led to the Abrahamic religions, and if the priest of the time really did manufacture Jesus Christ as some sort of metaphor or code for these mushrooms, these plants, and these rituals, then they clearly failed to preserve their original meaning. Because as Noel, I think you pointed out earlier, the vast majority of Christians today do not believe this idea. And if preservation of these mysteries was the key, wouldn't the priest have wanted people to know? Unless, that is, of course, the Catholic Church has a few very, very well-kept secrets, more than we suspect, up their sleeves, which I would be very surprised. But it's true, the Catholic Church has a lot of secrets.
Those vaults, buddy.
I was about to say, they've got like whole rooms that are just for secrets, right? They're especially fitted to house various shapes and flavors of secrets.
Now, just to be fair here, I think if these mystery religion cult leaders were trying to get all of this stuff down in this incredibly complex allegory, and they're doing mushrooms on a consistent basis, I think if it's true, they did a pretty darn good job. Because, I mean, they're writing the thing.
So, a hat tip to you, mystery religion priests, for keeping it together with a head full of dreams.
That's right.
We want to hear from you. Have you explored this idea yourself? What's your take on this? Is this maybe just a fringe theory where someone's just out there to be out there on the fringes? Is there something to it? Because again, those depictions, those paintings do have clear depictions of mushrooms, but is this author reading too much into it, or is there something there?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts on this, you guys. Do you, listening out there, do you have any ideas or thoughts on this subject? I'm sure you do. Have you tried one of these substances and experienced something? Maybe don't write to us about that. Maybe that's a bad idea.
No, right.
That.
No.
Is that a bad idea?
Of course it's not a bad idea.
We will not compromise your identity, and if you wish, we will use an alias.
And again, don't do it.
But if you've happened to find yourself into that position where you've happened to do it, it'd be cool to hear about it.
Yeah, right? Okay.
That's
okay.
Not being irresponsible.
We legally cannot tell you to do drugs.
But if someone you know does, send us a message.
Are we fired?
Yep. This is probably the one.
Speaking of messages, it's time for...
Shout Out Corners.
So we received a lot of feedback on our earlier episode called Lake City Quiet Pills,
mm-hmm.
which is about a Reddit mystery. And we wanted to share with everyone some of the follow-up correspondence we had, which really surprised us. We have one email that came to us through a blocker, meaning that we were able to read it like what you would read an anonymous post. We do not know the identity of this person, which both means we cannot verify it, and we can't really make any definitive decisions, but we'd like to read it to you. Hello, Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Long-time listener, though never expected to be reaching out, especially not like this. I had a bit of a personal revelation during your episode referencing Lake City Pills. More than 10 years ago, I walked in on my father visiting a jailbait pornographic website. I was aghast, and he screamed that we should never speak of it, which made perfect sense to me. However, I was terrified by what he was doing, so I installed a keylogger on his computer to determine if this was accidental on his part or if I needed to reach out to the authorities.
Wow.
The keylogger generated normal usage data and rather generic pornographic terms late at night, only occasionally referencing the same jailbait site, old guy's image hosting, and then followed by what at the time I felt was gibberish. I felt it was gibberish until I heard you three read the same sort of code out in the air on this podcast, and I immediately broke out into a cold sweat. There is additional information that ran home that my father was involved in this, though some of it is too on the nose in its identification of those close to me to be even able to verify that information. Suffice to say, he went on far too many business trips for one in his position. I suppose I should also mention that though retired prior to 9/11, my father was a Ranger, later a member of Delta. He came in during the 80s and spent extended time doing ground operations in the Middle East. I can still remember getting letters from him with every word redacted aside from "love, Dad" at the bottom. I can also clearly remember Blackwater coming to recruit my father post 9/11, which was unnerving and unannounced. He refused their offer. My father has also gone on at length in private regarding the important role extrajudicial killings serve in keeping the relative peace in the world. He is very much in needs of the many, outweighs the needs of the few. I will not be able to receive any replies to this mailbox. I also apologize for not providing any proof to you, but it's an unnecessary risk for me. Thank you. It is strangely comforting to find out so many years later that my father is a murderer and not a pedophile. Sometimes bad people need a quiet pill so good people can sleep peacefully. Unsigned.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Our second one, our second piece of correspondence. Thank you to whoever that was. Second piece of correspondence.
I think one reason, no need to comment on that, because if you heard the episode, you understand what an amazing artifact that is, and we really do appreciate you sharing and shedding some light on this system that we talked about. That we honestly, there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, if it is, you know, true, because we can't confirm or deny any
right,
of it.
Right.
But let's move on. Our second piece of correspondence comes from someone who signs their letter T, and it says, to conspiracy. Hey guys, Dutch Milo was not part of a hit squad. He was associated with a military contracting service. He would get people in touch with a gentleman named Thomas Leahy, who after being removed from DPD, began recruiting for a company called Alpha Omega Security Solutions. Milo was friends with Alpha Omega because their operations in Central America led to a large amount of association in things that Milo had an interest, i.e. child porn. Ugh. Milo helped recruit and some people returned the favor. He did not die peacefully and his philosophy of some people being evil so they just needed to go was what ended up leading to his demise. Wow.
And our final shout out today is for Ron B. He says, I've been a fan of the podcast since the videos first started coming out and I was zapped temporarily off to a reality where it disappeared.
When I finally made it back to this reality, I discovered that there was now an audio version, which I'm thoroughly enjoying. That's good to hear. Thank you. I just got done listening to your Crime, Kidnapping, and Organs, the Red Market episode, and I couldn't help but write about it. During the parts of the episode where the Oregon Trail was being discussed, I could not help but think of the game The Oregon Trail. The game is done faithfully to the old-school Oregon Trail graphics and playstyle, but with zombies and a wood-paneled station wagon in lieu of the covered wagons. It even has the first person you meet die of dysentery. Anything less would be a travesty. That's my line, not Ron B's. Keep up the good work. I look forward to the notifications that pop up in the app with each new episode. Oh, man, he even gets the notifications.
Whoa.
On the app. Ron B, thanks. And speaking of that reality, with lack of videos, what'd it do, guys?
We're back in the game.
We're back in the game!
You can expect more from us soon. You can also find our first long-form documentary on the Georgia Guidestones that all three of us put a lot of effort in for free on Amazon.
Yeah, if you go to Amazon, search Guidestones or Etched in Secret. You could even search for Ben Bolin if you want to.
Or Matt Frederick.
Or Noel Brown.
Yeah.
And you'll find it.
And this concludes... But not our show. We are going to head out and work on a number of things. In the meantime, we want to hear from you. Do you have information about this topic that you think would illuminate your fellow listeners?
Globally and unlimitedly?
If so, let us know. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and you can write to us directly.
We are conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.